The Theodore Roosevelt Rotunda at the American Museum of Natural History in New York is a grand cathedral to a giant.
Look at that tail. It's a huge dinosaur.
The largest freestanding dinosaur display in the world, a Barosaurus, towers 5 stories overhead. But downstairs, tucked away in a basement corner, is a temple of the tiny.
Okay, we're on the lower level of Section 11 in the museum.
Cigarette smoke wafts in from the alleyway. Pipes hiss and hum overhead. Sometimes they've leaked.
We were sort of in back in marine conditions for a brief period of time. Appropriately enough.
Appropriately enough, because squeezed into a corner of this hallway is Micropaleontology Press. It's devoted to publishing hundreds of volumes of catalogs of all of the microscopic fossils in the world, the protozoa and tiny crustaceans, which are found in untold numbers on the ocean floor. If you're a micropaleontologist, these catalogs are your Bible. John Van Coovering has been the editor-in-chief here since 1978. He's 72, he's wearing blue jeans and hiking boots, and yes, there's a piece of tape holding the earpiece of his glasses together. He bubbles with passion for microfossils.
They're innumerable. If you think about the open ocean out there, what accumulates on the bottom of the ocean is a steady rain of fossil remains from microscopic organisms, like falling like dust over the years. And they can represent deposition over tens and tens of millions of years, each annual layer the thickness of a piece of paper. And when you drill through those, and you look at the fossils as they change through those different layers, you're looking at a tape recorder of geological history.
We've come to visit John Van Coovering because of this historical fact. Micropaleontology Press is itself a kind of fossil, a relic of time gone by, and it's about to lose its longtime home at this museum. The press's roots stretch back to 1928. It started with one geologist's determination to compile a complete catalog of thousands of single-celled microfossils. The project got government grants during the Depression to keep it going. At its peak in 1935, it was part of Franklin Roosevelt's Works Progress Administration. It had more than 200 employees, catalogers and indexers, and artists who created meticulous, gorgeous drawings of microfossils.
I have photographs of a whole room full of these guys, all in neckties and white coats, and I always wonder what they could have thought. These are unemployed artists, it's the Depression, they're out of work. And some guy comes along and says, would you like a job drawing pictures of microfossils? Sure, I'll draw anything.
Ever since 1942, Micropaleontology Press has been happily housed at the Museum of Natural History. But time marches on. The press used to be on the main floor, behind the Eskimos. It was booted downstairs back in the 80s to make way for ichthyology. Bit by bit, its basement space has been surrendered to other museum functions, the museum shop visual room, DNA sequencing, and frozen tissue labs. And now the museum has decided that Micropaleontology Press and its 5 staffers have to clear out.
Now they want the space back.
Which means that decades of micropaleontological records are being packed away, layered like so much sedimentary evidence of the work that goes on here. Boxes are stacked up to the ceiling. They're labeled planktonic binders, diatom 2001, and party goods. Stained and creaky furniture lies about, scavenged from the museum dumpster. But what dominates the room is a battery of battered gray filing cabinets, hundreds of drawers devoted to the multisyllabic minute.
We just take a drawer at random here. Here we get some Vandenbrückia, Variostoma, Vasocerta, Velepertina, Villa, Volvulina, Xenotheca. That's the end of the foraminifera. When you get into it, when you get into these names, they just roll off the tongue.
And they do. You could spend a happy day thinking of the particular character of Crystallaria, Elphidium, or Quinquilaculina.
Iliocypromorpha. Jonesina. Okay.
That's a great. There's like music in there, really.
I don't know. I think maybe the paleontologists like it when the name has got a bit of a ring to it.
And more of these microfossils are being discovered and named all the time. Study these tiny beings, John Vancouvering explains, and you realize they contain a kind of time code. They hold a wealth of crucial detail about climate change, plate tectonics, and worldwide geological events. The microfossils point the way to reserves of oil and natural gas. They're telling stories for anyone who wants to listen.
They're telling you how old the rocks are, and they tell you when things are changing. It's like canaries in a coal mine. You don't get that from dinosaurs. There's not enough of them.
And how many microfossils would you say there are?
Oh, how many microfossils are there? How many do you think there are?
Billions.
Let's take the Chalk Cliffs of Dover.
The White Cliffs of Dover
White
in
Cliffs
the sun?
White Cliffs of Dover,
sure.
right. They're, what, 400, 500 feet high? That formation can be followed all the way from northern England into southern France at that thickness. And think of the tonnage of rock involved. That rock, that chalk, is composed of nothing but submicroscopic microfossils.
So I underestimated is what you're trying to tell me.
You underestimated.
And if I underestimated their number, I also underestimated their beauty. They're tiny, but magnified by electron microscopes, they reveal themselves to have magical shapes. Many of the fossils have secreted fantastic mineral shells that protect the cell nucleus. John Vancouvering pulls out photographs of some beauties.
There's a good one in here that I want you there.
Oh,
it is.
That?
That's another foraminifera. Most foraminifera start off with little round chambers, and they add more bigger chambers. So this one looks rather like a dripping pine cone, or a ice cream cone that was very badly made.
Some of the microfossils look like hubcaps, others like peanut shells. One show-off has trumpets that look like morning glories, stretching out of a core of sand dollars.
A lot of people are very fond of operculinus. They're quite beautiful.
Does it still seem like a vital thing that you're doing here? Or does it seem like an anachronism and an old science that
Okay. You've touched upon a very sensitive point here. We're kind of the Pennsylvania station of science here.
Let's just explain here for people who don't live in New York. You're referring to Pennsylvania Station, which was the beautiful old train station torn down, gutted.
Beautiful old train station that was in the way for somebody's new modern development and got torn down before anybody could say, wait a minute. Well, we're kind of that way. We're a wonderful old structure with a tremendous investment in the data and so forth. And we are being salvaged. We're salvaging ourselves because we still have a function.
They're salvaging themselves by heading out on their own. They're becoming a nonprofit corporation and are moving to a new space downtown. Sometime next week, the last moving van will pull away and take Micropaleontology Press to its new home, the latest stage in its own long evolution.
Metasithiropteron, Microchylinella, Microcytherura,
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Microparaparchites.